I'm Jamie Waxman, and this is the Hot Socks Podcast. Today, I'm sitting at this really wobbly green circular table with an amazing non-wobbly and not very green woman who calls herself Tizzy Wall. You can check her out online at, she has a Tumblr, which is Primless. Is it the Primless?
It's the Primless Life.
The Primless Life. Tumblr. Whatever goes after that, but you know what I mean. I first met Tizzy a few months ago when I moved to San Francisco. A dear friend of mine, Editrix Abbey, who always writes really funny things about online dating and pretty, again, my favorite title ever, No Cunty for Old Men. I first met Tizzy a few months ago at a bar, and I don't know if you remember this, but we were all having a conversation about if a woman got pregnant and the guy had not wanted the baby, mm-hmm. what the responsibility was, and we got into a real heated debate over it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I remember that. I think it continued to the Mexican.
Yeah, it was at the Mexican joint.
Yeah, we had this huge, really intense conversation about it. Yeah.
And then there was a woman outside. You were very passionate. You're very passionate. You have a background in the arts, and you got really passionate about what was going on, and a woman actually knocked on the window and said, "Calm down or you're going to have a heart attack."
I forgot about that, but I remember it now that you bring it up. I get people say that kind of crap to me all the time. So it's like not surprising that someone did it then too.
So, I mean, you stand out. There's no doubt about it. You have a presence and a look and a lot of really smart opinions as well. And I'm very excited because you're actually going to help me out. Tizzy's here for a podcast, but also to be an intern for me for the next few months while I write The Wake Up Call and other things, work on gasm.org. So we're going to do that together. But since it was our first day together, I decided that we were going to throw fuel to the fire and throw the logs right in there and do a podcast, because this is actually how I got my start in sex ed. Was I was a producer on a radio show, and the first day of the show, the host brought me on and said, "Tell me about your sex life," which isn't what I'm going to say to you exactly. And from there, I found my calling. Now, I think you already found your calling. You're an amazing writer, and you do video reviews of sex toys, and you post about, lots of different experiences. You are fairly young. Yes. I don't know if you tell people your age or not.
Not usually, but I don't mind.
Okay, I won't even say it. Okay. But I'll just say that you have a lot of life experience for someone under 30.
Thank you.
And it's funny, I haven't come from LA, and I had a really hard time saying I was 37 for a few years. I'm like, people shouldn't know my age. Like, even on Facebook, it doesn't say my birth date. Mm-hmm. And now I'm like, F it. I'm 37. Like, what's the alternative? Like, death. I don't care. I'm just going to keep growing older. But when I lived in LA, people would say, don't tell people your age. Don't ever tell people your age. So I think it's just me rebelling from SoCal. So you have a number of different interests in the field of sexuality.
Yes.
Why don't you let people know a little bit? You write for Playpen.
Yes, for the Playpen Report, which is connected to playpen.com. I write a column about my day job, I guess.
And what is your day job?
I am a professional dominatrix.
Now, when you say it's a day job, is it something that you... Is it more of a night job or a day job?
It really is a day job. It's actually funny because when I first started, I was working evenings because I was working at my other job. I was working at the domestic violence shelter I was working at. And so I was taking night shifts, but then I actually realized that I wasn't getting any work at nights. And then when I took a day shift, I realized I'm apparently a daytime girl. I'm a lunch hour businessman dominatrix, not a nighttime, not a Saturday night. My coworker told me I don't look slutty enough for nighttime work, apparently.
Wow. So what is the, this is interesting. I had no idea that there was really a difference. So yeah. There's like the day dom and the night dom.
Yeah. Well, it's just, and everybody, I've been trying to figure it out because I think it's really fascinating that everybody, I work out of a house of BDSM and everyone's really different. I mean, gorgeous, but everyone's like different body types, different races, different heights, different everything, like absolutely everything is different about everyone. And it's interesting because just some people, everybody has their days that they find out work for them. I mean, consistency helps a lot. If you go the same, if you have the same schedule, then people know when you're there and that makes it easier. But also some people, I've had coworkers who they get you know, a ton of work on Saturday nights. But if they come in on a Monday morning, they get nothing. Ever.
Wow.
Even if they stay consistently, they just get nothing. And for me, it's the opposite. For me, it's if I work daytimes, I actually have a better chance of making some money. Whereas if I come in when I did night shifts, I would just work for weeks and not get anything at all.
So when you say that you work and make or don't make money, how does it work to come into the house that you work at? Is it people make appointments before? Can they just show up?
No. I heard that in LA that's what they do. That like everybody just hangs out and they like hang out in the like in their dorm where.
Because I'm thinking like the cat house on HBO where like a guy walks in or a girl walks in and there's like a line of people and you pick someone.
No, see, that's crazy to me. And also I hate the concept of that because I'm like, we're not like Bleach at the grocery store. We're like grosses me out. I've actually told clients that on the phone because they do have to call and make an appointment. I've actually told them, be like, we're not Bleach. You can't just come in and we're not going to line up for you. No, they have to make an appointment in advance. They can make same day appointments.
And they can
like
see who you are online.
Yeah. I mean, there's like, we all have profiles and they can see our pictures and, you know, they can email us too and find out if they have like a very specific fetish or fantasy, they can email us and ask about it. So it works where it's like, it's kind of like freelancing in the sense that it's, you know, you have to market yourself, you have to network, you have to do all that, and you can, you know, get gigs that way. But then also the benefit of working in a house as opposed to being independent is that sometimes, you know, someone just wants to come see someone at the house. So they'll call and say, who's there? And then they'll look, oh, those are the people who are there. Oh, of that, so-and-so fits my interests the best. So I'm going to book with her because she's available today when I'm available also.
So what makes you an appealing day worker? Like, is it just your physical?
I have no idea. I can't figure out exactly what the rhythm is for everybody. I don't know what it is. I mean, like I said, my coworker told me when I asked her, because I was complaining about not getting work at nights, and she told me that I wasn't slutty enough for nights. And I'm like, my boobs are on the internet. I don't know how, like...
Yeah, what does it mean?
Like,
I'm always interested in that word slutty, too. Like, what does slutty mean?
Well, I think she was saying it jokingly. But, you know, it's one of those things where, yeah, I don't know. Apparently...
So who do you work best with? Like, who do you tend to see? Businessmen? Well, who comes to a dom house?
Oh, God, everybody. Everybody. We get a lot of, I mean, mostly because it's also an expensive indulgement to go see a dom. We
it's
get
a
people
luxury.
Who have money, get a lot of dudes from the financial district.
Who come on their lunch break?
Or who, like, take the morning off of work type of thing. We also get people who, you know, I've had clients who are working out some therapy stuff type things and working out demons that they just want to talk about. We get some dudes who mostly just want to be bossed around by a pretty lady. They don't really want anything fetishy or actually BDSM really at all. They literally just want me to be like, don't do that, and, like, be pretty. I had a guy who came in who he'd never done strap-on play before, but he was interested, but he was too nervous to ask any of the girls he dated, even though he was like, he said, I think they would do it. The kind of girls that I date are kinky and they would probably do it. He's like, but I feel like I'm just so unprepared. I really want to do it with somebody who knows what they're doing and where it's like no judgment and I don't have to feel weird. If I do feel weird. So he wanted to explore it in a space where it wasn't tied up in emotional stuff.
He says, I want to go to a place where people know what they're doing. How do you learn what you're doing? Like, how do you, like, you probably know before he comes in that he wants to do strap-on play.
Yes.
So you can practice. Like, what do you do to practice? Like, how do you get all of these skills?
Well, I know that the place that I work at, they actually do training, which is awesome. A lot of it is, like almost anything else, a lot of it's kind of winging it. I mean, you figure out the basics. You know, there's some education on the basics. And before I started, I actually was interested in sexuality and I was already pretty kinky on my own. And also, frankly, at least with men, with anal play, if you've had anal sex yourself, I think you get a pretty good sense of what not to do to somebody else. So there's also that element of learning from having your own experiences.
So they do trainings there. Yeah. You see these clients. And what is the most... Is there a most popular or common request? Is it the being bossed around?
That's really hard to say. Because, again, also, it's different depending on who you are. It's the same thing as, like, kind of the time of day thing. For me, I get a lot of sensual dom sessions, which is mostly, again, like bossing people around. Sometimes it involves pain, but a lot of times it mostly is, I don't get a lot of, I don't know, pain sluts. So
how did you figure out that you wanted to do this, be a dominatrix?
Funny story about Abby, actually.
Oh, right.
Abby, yeah.
We love you, Abby. By the way, where can people find you on Twitter? Is it Tizzy
Wall? It's Tizzy Wall, at Tizzy Wall.
And that's TizzyWall.
Yes.
Great.
Yes. So how I actually figured this out was I had found it really interesting before. And like I said, it was kinky. And I had this really intellectual interest in BDSM and fetishes. I find it really, really interesting. And then I saw a Craigslist ad looking for doms. And I read it and I sent it to my email and I sat on it for like 3 weeks. I was like, I'm not sure about this. I don't know enough about it. And like, I tried to Google like dominatrix interview job, you know, to try and figure out like what happens. And like everything I read was really scary or not related at all. And I'm like, oh my God, like one of the things I read I read some blog about how they were like, yeah, I went in for the interview and like they said, well, let's see what you're made of, and handed me a whip and then opened the door and there was someone on the floor. And I was like, oh my God, if that happens, I can't do it. That would just freak me out so much. So Abby, this is actually right before Abby and I, we met for the first time in person. We talked online, but then we met for the first time in person and went to drinks. And I said, you know, okay, I know you've done some of this work or you know things about this. I have questions. And she encouraged me. She was just like, go for it. Go do it. She said, if you hate it, you can quit. Just try it.
So what happened when you went in?
The interview was not scary at all. It was actually a totally normal interview. The woman who runs the whole place is awesome. She's like one of the most amazing people. And very supportive. And she just basically broke down the basics. And it was very no nonsense, especially because a lot of people interview and a lot of people come into the house for a first day or for the first couple weeks and then don't end up finding out that it's not what they expected and it's not really what they want to do, which is fine. It's not for everyone. But the interview was really easy. It was not scary at all.
And how long have you been there now?
I've been there for almost a year. I'm still pretty new.
What is the legality around being a dominatrix? Is there?
It's an iffy line because I know in California, basically anything that is considered, anything that could give someone sexual pleasure is considered, that they pay you for, is considered prostitution or could be argued to be prostitution. It's like this very vague law. I don't know exactly the wording, but it's like this super vague. It's like you could, and consent is you could like, I know that I've heard stories about someone being busted by, you know, the cops and it's like, they didn't even agree to actually have sex, but they smiled and nodded. So that means that they consented and therefore they were a prostitute, that sort of thing.
Because you know what happened in New York recently around
the condoms.
Yeah, with
the condoms. Yep.
That was if you're carrying a condom, you could be considered a prostitute.
Yeah, which is
crazy.
Insane. And totally like, wow, way to, I'm sure that they're checking all the pockets of men to see how many condoms they have. So
right.
They can.
And why would you not want people to carry condoms?
Well,
that's
yeah.
Like the other part of it. It's like, so you're saying have unprotected sex just in the rare case that we might look through your wallet because we think you might be doing the oldest profession in the world that people will always pay for regardless of if we keep busting it?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so you've been doing this, the dom work is fairly new. It's only been a year for you. And, and how has it changed you as a person?
It's actually, especially the first couple months, I avoided writing about it because it was so much to process. I think it's changed a lot for me in terms of my sexuality is completely, it's much better defined. And it's also very different in the sense that before I couldn't have conversations about my own sex and about what I wanted, about the things that I really wanted, things that I really wanted to explore. I was just really afraid to have that conversation. I identify as a feminist and I was definitely knew about slut shaming and about whorephobia and I knew about all those things and I would defend, you know, I would stand up for people if something was said that was inappropriate in that sense and I would do all that, but I hadn't really, I guess, self-actualized that or, you know, I really still had some shame about being promiscuous even though I'd been happily and willingly promiscuous. Before that, I would have this real back and forth within myself about feeling shameful and feeling like, oh, you know, if somebody rejects me, maybe this is why, and I can't ask for what I want, and getting kind of all wrapped up in my own head about sex and about sexuality and things like that, and being forced to have the conversation over and over again in negotiation before we actually go into session, you know, talking about what's going to happen and what the boundaries are. Having those conversations over and over again, and also seeing these people who came in and they were so ashamed.
Of what they wanted.
Yeah. Yeah. And just to the point where like they could barely talk about it. They wouldn't look at me. And I'm like, this is what we're here for. If we can't talk about it here, like this is the safest space. I think also having the community of women who there is like no shame. It's kind of one of my coworkers always says, and this just always plays back to me. She always says, don't yuck someone else's yum.
Oh my God. That's the best line ever.
Isn't it? And it's having that be there and having it also be, a bunch of women who really own their sexuality and who have, you know, everyone identifies their sexuality differently, but a lot of them have had queer experiences or have had the range of experiences, have dated lots of different people, have had sex with lots of different people, have, you know.
Does sex actually, vaginal penile penetration, happen often in domination situations?
No, it's very, I mean, I know that there are some escorts who do BDSM work in addition to their services, but most doms that I have known do not do any kind of sex stuff, unless they're doing it for like porn type things.
Or like a strap like, on where yeah. you're not, yeah. you're wearing.
Which is arguably sex. But, like, in terms of there's no, like, at least for the place that I work, none of that that's, like, a house rule. There's no vaginal sex, anal sex, oral sex, hand jobs, foot jobs, none of nothing.
So you don't do hand jobs, foot jobs to clients or anything?
No.
Oh, okay.
It's, like, literally, it's, like, the only time I touch someone's penis is if I'm causing it pain.
You know, that brings up something else I'd like to talk about, which is cock and ball torture.
I love cock and ball torture.
Okay, so I just... How do you do it? I'm just fascinated by it. So I'll just like get that sentence out because,
okay.
So I just did the San Francisco sex information training. Mm-hmm. You and I were talking about mm-hmm. that. And as part of it, you watch a lot of pornography in a mm-hmm. short period of time. And I mean, honestly, like I don't admit this very much, but I watched a lot of porn in my life. I do it for work. I don't really watch a lot of porn anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I hadn't seen everything that was out there. And we had a number of screens going for a long period of time. And I, when the cock and ball torture came on, was like, I can't stop watching and I can't figure out if I'm okay with this. And it brought me back to something a year ago now, Jaylene Bennis, who's this amazing massage therapist and also she specializes in bondage. She does something mm-hmm. called bondassage.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She had me come down to her place and she hired someone to come in and she showed me what a bondassage massage was like. And I now remember there was some cock and ball torture in it. And she had me do some work with her to try and get my dommy side out. But I'm like, are you okay? Is that too tight? Like, I'm really not very good at being like, that's how it is. And I was so scared about that. Like, how do you do that?
Well,
right?
The funny thing is there are ways. So, okay, this is something that also, and we talked about this earlier with coming from a counselor background, a lot of it is, how are you feeling? I mean, that's like the stereotypical question, but a lot of it is kind of assessing how someone is doing and really being invested in their well-being. And at least for me, I don't find domination fun if the other person's not having fun as well. And also I'm really, really caught up on consent. I'm like obsessed with Kitty Stryker and Maggie Mahan's consent culture. And I'm just really,
that's great,
all about it being fun for everyone. Because if it's not, I don't want to do it anymore. You know, especially coming from a background as a rape survivor, like for me, the consent thing is so important. I just, I can't get past it. So it was definitely something that I struggled with when I first started to have that, like, is this okay? Is this okay? And you can't be that way. You have to kind of take on a little bit of a persona. But there are ways that there are tricks to figure out how to ask, is that okay? And also to encourage people to communicate with you. Like in negotiation, I tell everyone, especially when if I've played with them before, then we've already had this conversation and we've got a relationship going. But if it's someone new, I always tell them, I'm like, it's really important to me that you communicate. These are the safe words. We also have we have the, of course, the, yellow, red, you know, yellow slow down, red is stop.
And then we also have green.
Yeah. So it's like, I even tell them, I'm like, green, I'm telling you green because you may think, oh, why would I need that? But if you get really deep in subspace and you can't communicate anymore, if I check in with you, you need to say one of these three words if you cannot get anything else out. Okay.
That's really smart to have the green there for that reason.
Yeah. Because sometimes, I mean, I know that for me, when I'm submissive in my personal life, sometimes I get so to the point where I like can't even talk anymore. It's like, I totally just fall into myself and I can't communicate anymore. And so it's useful to have that one thing, that way everybody's still on the same page, you know, that way it doesn't become something that's non-consensual, and that line is so thin, you know, when there's, if it's not communicated enthusiastically, and especially with BDSM play, how fast it can move from everything is fine to everything is not, is it's split second change.
What is it for men, like, about the cock and ball torture? Like, I've talked to a lot of guys that either, that they're like, I just don't get it. So what do you think, what do you see when you work with clients? I'm, like I said, I'm really like kind of in my head every day. I have this, it's kind of strange, I guess, but vision for a moment of the balls being like totally tight and like just hit.
If you wanted me to tell you a really horrible cock and ball torture, I can do that for you.
Oh my God. All right, if you don't like this part,
trigger warning, cock and ball torture.
And all right, okay.
Okay, so this is actually not, this is actually last week.
This was like really
Yeah,
new.
Yeah, I won't tell you the worst part of the story. Well, I can tell you later.
It's, did like his balls get broken? No.
No. So it's actually really hard. So interesting thing, it's actually really, really hard to permanently damage testicles. You have to like twist them and like twist them and cut off circulation. It's like, it's actually really, really hard to really damage them. You can, the human body in general, I'm learning, like, the human body is really durable. It's actually really hard. I mean, if you do it the wrong way, then it's not that hard to hurt them, I guess. There are some parts of the body that are just very vulnerable, but with the like fleshy parts of the body, it's not, you can just beat the crap out of somebody and they'll be fine. I mean, they'll be in pain, but they'll be fine. But we had this guy come in, and literally all he wanted, it was me and a coworker of mine. It was a double, and doubles are super fun because we basically get to hang out, and kind of the common thread amongst all of the doms that I know is that whereas everybody else finds it weird or unsettling, we all find it funny. And I don't know what it is. It's just, there's this common thread of all of this is hilarious.
When you're working in a team or just in general?
Just in general. When we talk about it later, like the jokes are totally raunchy. And if I tell, sometimes I get a bad filter with this and I'll start telling the jokes. You know, I'll be talking with friends who are what I like to call normies, who are like non-kinky.
In porn,
people.
They call them civilians.
Yeah. See? Those folk, well, sometimes I'll forget that they're not totally on the same level with that, and I'll start telling jokes and they're just like big eyes and oh my God, what are you saying, what is that, oh my God, and I'm like, oh, oops. But you know, at the Dom House, it's all laughs, but with this guy, so he came in and he basically only wanted cock and ball torture, and he had actually told my coworker, she's the one who negotiated with him, and she he said in negotiation, he'd booked with her, and he said in negotiation, oh yeah, if you have someone else, like, she seems cool, that would be cool to do a double. So we went into session, and of course we're thinking like cock and ball torture. That's like, you know, we're kind of mean, obviously. But we're thinking like cock and ball torture for like, she was going to be in with him for like 2 hours, and I was going to be in with him for an hour of that 2 hours. And I was coming in kind of in the middle, and I was thinking like the whole time, like that's just going to get boring after a while. Like, you know, I mean, it's fun, but anything you do for 2 hours straight is just like,
yeah, yeah.
Oh my God. Really?
Gotta switch it up.
Yeah. So, but he did tell us that he could handle, he said, 15 pounds of weight on his balls.
I love it too. How do you figure that out? Oh, I'll try 1 pound too.
Yeah, like, I think.
Did he hang 15 pounds of weight on his balls to figure
well,
that
out? Well, I think he'd seen a mistress before elsewhere. But I don't think she was that mean to him because he was very overwhelmed. And we basically, so first we started off with warming him up, which means we've like flogged his cock. And she had, my coworker had tied him up real tight, you know, did the cock
and
ball
bondage.
The thing
that I'm thinking of where the balls look like they're going to explode.
Yeah, because it makes everything so sensitive. It brings all the blood, you know, makes it really delicate, I guess, more delicate. But we were warming him up and taking turns flogging him. And we had him like strung up on the X. And we're flogging him, and then And then we took him down and we moved him. We gave him a break. Oh, well, actually, I'm sorry. I'm jumping ahead. We actually kicked him in the balls a bunch of times.
He liked that?
Well, the thing is that it's like, it's mixed feelings. I don't know. I mean, have you ever been, have you been submissive? Have you done any kind of pain stuff?
I'm much more submissive than I am dominant.
Do you like pain?
Yeah, I can, and I have a high tolerance. I have a threshold that's pretty high for pain, but you have to start slow.
Yeah, and build. Right. Yeah, and so, but tell me if this is the way for you too. Like, I like some pain. I'm not like a total, you know, I'm not super,
I'm not
super
a pain
masochistic.
Junkie.
Yeah, no, not at all. But I definitely, like, I'll have times where even if the slow build up, like, it'll feel really intense and maybe I'll feel like it's too much or it'll still be like, ow, it doesn't stop being pain. It's just that in the context of the situation, it creates a different response. And I think it's the same thing for these dudes who want to be tortured, is that it still hurts, but within the context of what's going on,
it works.
It creates a different reaction.
Sure.
Yeah, it's the same thing.
Right, like if you say I'm going to kick a guy in the balls, it just in general, it's like, oh my God, that's horrible. But in that situation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he had two pretty girls who are dressed up in total
and
outfits.
Are you wearing shoes when you kick him?
I was. She wasn't. She was just wearing her stockings.
Okay.
But for me, I was wearing my 6-inch heels.
Okay.
Because also I might have the ankle strap, and I don't like taking them on and off as a pain.
Okay.
So we kicked him in the balls, and what we did was we, you know, it would be like he'd get a little reward. So she was like, I'm going to kick you 5 times, and if you can handle all 5 times, we're going to take a break. And then we took a break, and then we hung 20 pounds of weight on his balls using the ball parachute.
What is the
ball
parachute?
It's like a little, it's a little piece of, like, usually leather. And you snap it around the balls or the ball and the cock.
So it's sort of like
little,
a cock ring? A ball?
Sort of. It's shaped, I don't know how to say it. It's shaped almost like cone. Like, it's almost like the cone of shame that you put on dogs.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
I love the cone of shame.
But it's like a little leather one, and you put it on depending on how they're shaped, because, you know, men are shaped
all different ways.
Human bodies, you know? So sometimes it's on the balls, sometimes it's on the cock and balls, depending on how it goes. It's supposed to be on the balls, though. And then it's got 3 little chains that hang down and come to a center ring, and on that ring you can hang weights.
Okay.
So we had these big, like, you know those big weights that you put on the end of barbells type
thing?
Yeah. So we had a bunch of those and did 20 pounds.
Okay.
And she swung it back and forth.
Whew.
Uh-huh.
I don't even have balls. Okay. And I do, just not those.
And then what we did was we gave him a break, got him some water, you know. The whole time that we're doing this, also we're reminding him to keep breathing, because that's a big problem, is that, like, to be able to handle pain, especially, and also, you know, you don't want anybody to pass out. That's not the ideal, at least not my goal.
Does that happen?
Apparently there is a client who comes in who occasionally passes out, and, like, there are, you know,
okay,
that there have been words about, like, him, just to be watched, be warned, he does pass out occasionally, and...
Okay,
you know.
Back to cock and ball torture.
Yes.
As I'm like, I'm holding myself.
Well, so then what we did was we strapped him up again, and we hit him a few times with a crop, and then we ended up taking, I think maybe like 25 clothespins and putting them in a sun shape on his balls.
Wow, 25 fit on those
balls. Well, it was like 20 here and then 5 on top of his penis.
Okay.
And then we hit them off with a crop.
Ah, because it's like when they go on, they hurt, and when they come off, they hurt. Okay.
Yeah, well, and also hitting them, and when you hit them, it hurts. It's worse because they, like, pull off. You don't just unclip them. They, like, pull off.
Okay.
We actually made his balls bleed. We had to stop hitting them off because his balls turned.
Now, do you check in after that? Like, do you check in the next week? Like, how are your balls?
No, because we don't always have contact with them, because there's a lot of, you know, we don't take full names necessarily.
Do they leave feedback with, like, is there a dead mother?
No. They can, though. And sometimes they'll email and they'll say, hey, thanks so much. I really appreciated that. There's also Redbook, which I'm not a super fan of because...
That is a service out here that tells you who's a rat. Oh, gives reviews,
it's like
right?
Yeah, and it's like an advertising. And they also have like a forum. And sometimes some of the Redbook guys are pretty okay. But then there's also a couple wankers who are really...
Now, do you know, was this guy married? Like, does he have to go home and explain? That's like the crazy thing. If you're in a relationship and you have to go home and explain why your balls are bleeding.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he did, because most people, they'll say no marks if they're, you know,
okay.
But which is actually the worst when someone comes in, they're like, I want you to hit me as hard as you can, but you can't leave any marks. I'm like, okay, then we can't hit you as hard as we can.
How do you do
it? I mean, like, there are ways to do that for sure. But it's not possible. Like, we have these people who are really, really masochistic, but they're like, I have to go home to my wife and 3 kids later. So I can't be marked. And you're like, well, okay. So then that's probably not going to happen that way. sorry, but I will do my best to inflict some good pain on
you. What happens if you leave a mark on someone who says no marks? That's because it's got to be hard to know. Like, I bruise easily. And even if I said no marks, it would be...
We really try to avoid it. I know that I did have a client once who told me he didn't care. He wanted marks, and I know he was married. And I actually asked him how he, when he came back again, I was like, how did you hide that? What did you do? Because I beat the crap out of him. He actually sent me photos of his marks, and it was awesome. But he told me that he would, like, hide in the shower with his back towards the wall.
So most of these guys, when they see you, if they're in relationships, do not tell their partners?
No.
Are there people who do? Are there couples who come in and she watches?
There are sometimes couples who come in and actually... Yeah, I mean, there are couples who come in and participate, and that's apparently really fun. I don't get couple sessions, apparently. I've never had one, but I have a couple coworkers who say that it's the best to have the couple in there and just having fun together, and it's amazing. I don't know. I mean, I think that there are a lot of... I had a whole thing that I wrote on Playpen Report about my theories on infidelity. We have, like, this one client, Bailey, who I wrote about, who... Bailey is his name, quote-unquote, his pseudonym for these purposes.
Yeah, you're not outing him.
Yeah, no. But he actually... He's awesome. He was this amazing, amazing client who came in, and he actually told me in negotiation that he was wearing a chastity device. And
well,
I was like...
Cock lock.
Yeah, and I'm like, ooh, who put him in that chastity device and then sent him to a mistress? So mean. So we go into session, and I actually asked him, I was like, so who did this to you? I want to know who's sending you. I mean, did you do this to yourself, or did somebody lock you up and send you? That's, like, so cruel. I just love it. And I love that they're complicit in you coming here. I don't know. The whole thing is fantastic.
Yeah.
And he started to, over the course of the session, started to kind of tell me his story. So it turns out his wife is actually in an acute care facility and has been for the past 3 years. And she used to be, they used to have a really kinky relationship, and she bought it for him. And he even said that, he's like, they have other ones that are newer and better than this one, but I can't, I wear this one. This is the one that I have to wear. And then I, was talking to him about it, and he was telling me that, he told me this super sad story. Basically, I'm not sure, he didn't tell me exactly what was wrong with her, what kind of illness she had. But it had kind of been going downhill for a long while, and she'd had good days and bad days where she just wouldn't know who he was and all this stuff. I guess one time, and he'd go and visit her, and how sad is this? He'd go and visit her, and she'd tell him stories about her life, and it would be stories of the two of them when they were, like, young and in love and when they were together and going on all these adventures.
How old is he now around?
I want to say he's, like, in his 60s.
Okay,
maybe?
So she wasn't, like, 30 anymore.
No. These aren't young folk. But he went to go see her, and she'd tell these stories. And then he'd try to tell her. He'd be like, that's me. And she'd go, oh, no, it's some young man. He didn't have a beard. It's not you.
Oh.
And, of course, he's like, oh, God. Aww. Like, so heartbreaking. And I guess early on in her stay in the acute care facility, she had a good day, and he was there. And she looked over at him, and it was clear that she, like, knew who she was. She recognized him. It was, like, a really clear moment. And she reached over and grabbed his crotch. And he had the chastity device still on. And he had just worn it. He'd put it on occasionally, but it wasn't the same without her. So he'd had kind of, been on and off with it. And he had happened to be wearing it that day. And she grabbed his crotch, and she felt it. And she said to him, oh, you still love me.
Oh.
So... Now he goes to see mistresses, and he, like, has an arrangement, which I won't get into the arrangement he has with another friend to keep up his kinky lifestyle that actually has, it's funny, it's a mutual friend of his and his wife's, and she knew the whole situation and now is involved, even though they don't have, like, a sexual relationship. But he goes to see mistresses because he's just like, this is a part of my health and well-being, and I love my wife, but my wife is not capable of giving me this part of that I need, and this is,
It's so, for me, those kinds of stories are very inspiring. Like, I just did this interview, I just wrote this article for Playgirl, and I interviewed 5 male escorts, and one of them said the best dates are the ones where I go on a date with the wife and the husband's watching me flirt with her, mm-hmm. and the fact that they have this genuine trust and love, even if this woman can't remember that she has this trust and love with this mm-hmm. guy, the fact that he honors that.
Yeah.
And, would probably even share the stories if he felt that it would I mean, maybe he does share them. Who knows?
Yeah.
Right? So that's the kind of stuff. I think that if more people went as couples or even individuals in the relationship being honest about it,
yeah,
it would just change people's sex lives with their partners for the better, not really ever for the worse, because that's one of the beautiful things about being a professional sex worker,
mm-hmm,
or whatever word people use, is you're not trying to... You're not there to date the person.
No. Well, that's just something that I think that a lot of people get confused about. And I think also, it's funny that you brought this up. I was thinking about this earlier today. I think a lot of people have a certain sense of ownership over their partner. Or they feel like, it's like, I came up with this analogy because I was thinking about it because Sabrina Morgan, which we were talking about her earlier, she had recently put out a call for sex workers to talk about what it's like for them to date and for the partners of sex workers to contribute their opinions. And both my partner and I responded on my Tumblr. And my partner and I were talking about it, and it's just like, we just don't have this ownership of each other. Like, I don't own him. It's kind of like if you have a company, I don't have 5% stock. I'm not a partner in the company. I don't get to make any decisions. I'm just, you know, top employee. Maybe my opinion matters, but he can also fire me anytime he wants and vice versa.
That's a great analogy.
Know? And it's, I think a lot of people though approach their relationships with like, they have an ownership of that person, whether they'll call it that or not. The fact that they're going to be like, well, my partner and I get to tell them what to do, or I would never let them do that. Or I would, you know, have that whole attitude about their relationship, I think it makes it so that they have that jealousy that is, you know, also, I'm like, that the funny thing about jealousy.
Jealousy is like one of the most useless emotions ever, because what, outside of sometimes some really great sex that comes as a result of having the fight that goes with the jealousy, what purpose, I mean, in life, like even like when my career, at this point in my career, I don't compare anymore,
mm-hmm,
but there was a long time where I did.
Mm-hmm.
And all I did was put myself in black holes of depression based on the jealousy, like, component of myself.
Well, because, I mean, jealousy is really, I think, really derives itself from feelings of inadequacy. It's not at all about other people. Like, people think, like, oh, I'm a really jealous person. I get so jealous when my partner flirts with somebody else. I'm like, that's not about your partner flirting with somebody else. Your partner doesn't have to do anything to make you jealous, actually. Like, you are feeling jealous because you feel inadequate, or you feel like you're not getting what you need, or you feel like you're not getting the attention that you need, or you want what someone else is getting that you're not, you know, because if everybody's getting it, then why would you feel jealous? You're like, well, great, you're being flirted with. He flirts with me all the time, or she flirts with me all the time. Why am I worried about it, you know?
And also the fact that, I mean, it goes back to who goes and why. I mean, I think it would be fascinating. You're in a very good place to even, like, do some sort of research later on of why people don't tell their partners about these sort of experiences. Like, because there's got, I mean, obviously it's something in our society and our culture, mm-hmm, and all of that. But the ownership thing came up to me about a year ago. I was in LA when I was living there doing a panel, and this woman, Eileen, was on the panel, and she was talking about, it was a lot about the questions. Most of the questions were coming about polyamory. And the, mm-hmm, truth is, I'm not polyamorous. It's just way beyond, I invest so much time in relationships to begin, mm-hmm, with, that to invest them in multiple relationships would just basically be like, I have no life. I have no work. I can't get my work done. I just know myself.
Mm-hmm.
But this was the big hot topic, and everyone wanted to talk about it. And this woman said, if you love somebody so much, why would you ever do anything that didn't make them happy? Why would you try and own them? And, mm-hmm, it really opened my eyes just to the fact of, like, if I'm with a partner down the road, I'm monogamish, but that doesn't mean, and that's why I probably use that term now more, it doesn't mean I couldn't see outside opportunities happening for both of us, mm-hmm, because it's going to only help our relationship to be able to say, like, I trust you and love you. I don't own you.
Mm-hmm.
And marriage and love, I mean, not love, love is an emotion, but the whole concept around it is a business. If we're going to be with our partner, like you said, it's a business. He or she is the CEO of their company,
mm-hmm,
and I like that top employee thing.
We're partners. We're partners. Like, we're two businesses that have come together to create a bigger thing, and if it doesn't work out, we can fire each other, and the opinions of the other company matter. You know, they're relevant, but they aren't the final decision. They don't get final veto. They don't get final say. They don't make ultimate decisions. If the company decides to move across the country because it needs to, there it goes.
Gotta
go.
And you either go with it or you don't. Yeah. Exactly. Now, are you more submissive in your personal life than you are dom? Or?
I am. I am a little switchy, definitely, but I'm more on the submissive side. it's really fluid. It's hard for me to really own a title. Like, it's really hard for me to pin down which side of that. I mean, I'd usually just say switch because it's I enjoy both, but for very different reasons. In my personal life, well, my partner is definitely not submissive. so sorry, I don't know if I'm supposed to talk about him on the podcast because I didn't check in about that, but that's whatever. He's fine. Yeah, so he's definitely not submissive at all. But, you know, we have some back and forth. We really both enjoy the power play. And that's something that I really like. I'm not a service sub when I get submissive. I don't want to, like, clean someone's shoes.
And, no,
like,
I don't want to be someone's little maid. I wouldn't do a very good job of it.
I don't really want any of that for me personally. That just doesn't work for me. But I like the power play. I like the fight. I like the,
yeah.
I'm totally a bratty sub too. I know some doms hate that. No, but I can't, some doms hate that, but I'm super bratty and I love the, like, let's mess with each other. Let's, like, go back and forth and let's have this whole battle. And
I feel like I'd be that same way. I mean, when people ask me, like, I've been asked recently to be more dominant,
yeah.
And that's really, people who even who know me, but a lot of people are like, you're a very dominant personality.
Mm-hmm.
I have a loud voice. I've always, like, I know what I want when it comes to certain things. When it comes to sex, I'm like a completely different beast and I'm way, way more submissive.
People make that assumption, you know? I mean, I have a pretty dominant personality as well.
You
and
do.
People make that assumption about, like I've told a couple people about what I do and they'll be like, oh yeah, I could have guessed that. I'm like, no, you couldn't, because I'm not like that in my personal life at all. I don't know how people like come up with these assessments of people's sexual personality. I'm like, you don't know anything. Like, you really don't know anything about anyone's sexuality. You cannot...
Based on what they look like, how they act, anything.
Nothing. Zero things.
I used to love that when I worked at Babeland in New York for years. Like, the guy in all leather would come in. And in my head, of course, it's like immediately you're like, oh, they're going over to the floggers and the canes. And then they're like, I've never touched a vibrator before. And then the guy in the business suit is like, what gives the loudest thud when you hit? And I'm like... Oh, I would have totally thought you were coming in for the vibrator.
Yeah.
You know? So you really, really, really don't know. I want to switch gears for the last part of the podcast. Before I do, I wanted to bring up something you said earlier. This brings the podcast to a different place for a little while.
Okay.
And I don't know how you feel about this. I haven't asked.
And okay.
I'm doing it on, you talked about being a survivor of rape.
Yes.
How did that... I don't know the story around that or
mm-hmm.
how old you were. Were you young when it happened?
Yeah, I was 13.
Was it? It was someone you knew?
Yes, it was actually my boyfriend.
Which happens more
yeah.
than any other
yeah.
type of rape out there is someone you know. How did you get to a place of strength around it?
That's a really hard question. It's funny because it's been a long time. I mean, it's been over 10 years since that happened at this
That's
point.
What brought you to the domestic violence job as well? Or...
You know, it kind of, not directly, because it was so long ago, and it took a really long time for me to call it rape. I could not call it rape for years afterward. I remember right after he and I broke up, like, I knew things were wrong, things were bad, and it was definitely, our relationship has, like, so many, when I went through, I actually originally got involved in domestic violence advocacy through Woman Inc., and I did their 40-hour domestic violence training, and I was on their crisis line and did all that stuff. And part of their training, they talk about teen domestic violence and how it's very common, surprisingly. And a lot of people, their parents won't know. It just, you know, doesn't come up. It just somehow isn't read, I don't know, discovered. And when I was learning about that, I was like, wow. I was like, I guess my relationship qualifies as domestic. Like, it was domestic violence. Like, I didn't see that. I mean... At this point, I had accepted that I was sexually assaulted and raped, and that all happened, but I didn't really see it in the context of this is domestic violence until I actually took that training, and they were going through the signs and things that qualify, and I was like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Like, blew my mind. My first relationship was that. But for a long time, I couldn't call it rape, and right after we broke up, I remember, you know, I was going through, like, sex ed in high school, and they'd be like, if anyone says no, even one no means it's rape. And I really had this, like, kind of cognitive dissonance about it where it was like, oh, well, yeah, that's rape. What they say, you know, no means no. And if there's not a yes, then that's rape. And that is what happened. But that can't be rape. What happened to me can't be rape because he loves me. And someone who loves me wouldn't rape me. And so, like, which, I mean, is not not logical, but I think it was just basically my brain preserving itself, you know, not being able to handle... This is what this really is. This is what happened to you.
And also, I think with the term rape, you often think of, like, a lot of extreme violence.
Stranger rape. You think, yeah. At least for, you know, a yeah. lot of people, you say rape, and they're like, oh, God, some strange man on the street. And so, I don't know. And then, like, for quite a long time afterward, I was very messed up. I showed signs of PTSD, and, like, I...
Did your mom have any...
My mom was working a lot.
Okay.
And just kind of, you know, and also my mom really didn't know the extent of what happened. It was kind of one of those things where crossed lines yeah. just didn't get picked up.
That happened.
You know, so I had some signs with that. And then I hit a point where I was like, when I was about like 17, 16, 17, I had hit a point where I was just like, oh, well, this doesn't bother me anymore. Like, I'm not affected by it. Like, yeah, that happened, but I'm totally over it. Like, it's fine. And during that time, I definitely had a couple of experiences that were very triggering and very upsetting. And I didn't totally make that connection. And it's really only been in the past couple years that I've been able to kind of explore that and feel strong about it. And also talking about it actually helps. I've always been really afraid to talk about it, because of the stigma against rape survivors and because of the whole thing. And also I feel like being a sex worker and a rape survivor, I am validating a very horrible stereotype. And I'm like, I just don't want to tell anyone, not because I'm even ashamed at this point, but just because I'm like, I don't want them to think, oh, of course she is. I'm like, no, fuck you. That's not how it works. Actually, I think that for me, that's actually worked. It's been a deterrent for doing pro BDSM. Whereas like I had this conversation once with a coworker where she said that part of the reason, because in the house that we work at, you can also be hired as a professional submissive or switch, and you start as a doing also pro sub sessions. I no longer do pro sub sessions because I find no joy in them. Like they've been very triggering for me. I've had like almost everyone I've had has ended with me either just feeling crappy or like really awful about myself and just awful in general, or has led to me being like in total tears, complete meltdown, like just not okay at all. Like, you know, it's ranged from not so great to really horrible. So I don't do it anymore. But I was talking to a coworker of mine who she does pro sub sessions, and she has for a long time, and she really, really enjoys it. She loves it, you know, when they're good, when they're a good dom, which is a whole other subject.
They don't get, they don't have to get tested to be a good dom.
No, but they just come in and we know, you know, I mean, if you do it professionally, you know, if someone's not good at it, you're like,
oh, I can imagine.
You're like, you can't hit me there. They're like, I'm going to hit your ankle with this flogger. And you're like, what are you doing?
That's bony too.
Or like, you know, I'm going to flog your chest, but instead I'll hit your face on accident because I can't aim. And you're just like, you just hit my face. Like, what are, okay, whatever. Or they just push a lot of boundaries, especially because there's a big thing about from clients wanting to get a, quote, real reaction, which means they're, like, they just act really inappropriately. And it's like, yeah, the real reaction you're going to get is me saying, like, I'm never going to see you again, and please go fuck yourself. Like I don't know. I would think that you would want me to enjoy this too, but really you just want to hurt me or bother me and see me respond to that, which is a whole very disturbing thing.
Do those guys get immediately like axed from?
It depends on how bad it is, you know, because the vast majority of them are annoying but benign. You know, it's like they're disrespectful, but it's kind of like not really a big deal, you know, because they don't take it over the top. They're not really like super crazy. They just like to push the buttons, you know. And for me, I have a very low tolerance for that, so I can't fake it. I can't be like, oh, you're such a good dominant. Thank you, master. I'm like, stop touching me. I can't do it. You know, I was talking with my coworker about pro sub sessions, and she said that part of the reason she feels like she can do it and she gets so much joy out of it, she's like, I've never been raped. I've never been really sexually assaulted.
Is that why you said it was hitting a lot of triggers and it goes back to that?
Yeah. And for me, if anything, it's like during those moments, I've had that thing where I'm like, maybe I can't do this. Maybe I can't do this job. Maybe I don't have the salt for it. I can't hang with it. I just can't do it. And I would think, if anything, it's funny that people make that stereotype. They think, oh, well, rape survivor, all sex workers have been raped or sexually assaulted, and that's why they're messed up about sex, quote unquote, and that's why.
Like porn people too.
Yeah. And it's like, actually, if anything, that makes me less likely to do it, less want to do it. It takes a lot for me to be able to be vulnerable, and even in a dominant position, you know, I'm in my underwear in a room with a strange man who could or could not be a rapist. I don't know, you know.
Is there much of a screening process?
There's really not, but we have security measures. So.
Okay.
So there's big security. That was one of my priorities when I went into the interview, was like, how safe is this? I that's really important to me. But you know, it's still a very vulnerable position. It still is, sure, like, you know, and it's even just uncomfortable to have someone trying to grope you and having to go, no, 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 no. That still can be very unsettling and upsetting. But you know, it's one of those things where she was saying that because she'd never had that, she could totally find joy in it, and she felt kind of invincible. And also, she's a bit older, so she said she kind of was like, I'm kind of not at the point where I'm vulnerable again yet. She's like, I'm not young and vulnerable, and I'm not old enough to really be vulnerable, which is not really true about rape, but I think and she knows that too, but I think it makes her feel a little bit invincible.
I also feel like, not knowing who this person is at all and whatever, but like, there's also just certain types of people, those who can turn their brain completely off and like be in the experience and not like actually ever think about what it means.
Mm-hmm.
And those who think a lot, who,
yeah,
where like, you know, I am not a rape survivor.
Mm-hmm.
I learned early on from ads and on subways. I had an emotionally abusive relationship,
mm-hmm,
where we were very mutually emotionally abusive.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it took me, it was my first relationship. I was 15, and it took, or second relationship, and it took me a long time to see that even and be like, holy shit, I was in an abusive relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first time I realized like there might be something negative around that experience that,
yeah,
I sort of just like accepted and embraced.
I think that's the important distinction that needs to be made. I think that's exactly the point, is that, you know, obviously the experiences that you have do define you in some way, because they're part of, you know, their sum is who you are, right? Like, you are the end result of all of these things that have happened to you, and it changes your perspective and, you know, shapes the way that you view the world and all that, those things, right? And how you come into the world as well, right? But that doesn't mean that, I don't know. I mean, it doesn't mean that, like you said, it's not making up for, you're not making up for it by getting involved in the sex industry in any way. Like, it's not, you know, you're not compensating for something,
no,
that happened how many years ago that, you know,
what
just,
I would
like
to do though, is I feel like this is something that has been triggered from all of the stuff that I have gone through in my life, is,
mm-hmm,
I would like to be able to help other people not feel bad or wrong or guilty or shame about whatever their experience was. Like, I'd like, that's why I am here some days, like,
yeah,
I want to be able to make people feel like whatever your experience was, you're still okay. Like,
mm-hmm,
you're a good person, like, whatever, not a good person. I don't know you. Maybe you're not a good person. Fuck you. But yeah, like, it's, we all come from, like, I think in our society, sex is still such a taboo subject.
Yes.
I know. I don't think, I,
yeah,
know it is. And, as a result, it is this up, like when I wrote my masturbation book, a very well-known sex person said to me, why are you writing that? It's already been done. And I'm like, because every few years, a new voice just has to say it for someone else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's, and I would love to see the day when people are like, oh, sex, we could all just talk about it because it's a part of our life. But,
mm-hmm,
you know, obviously people are coming to dom houses and seeking people out because they can't yet.
Yeah.
And I would like to just see whatever that movement is. And I mean, you do a lot online now, so you get to see the way it's building as a community. And I want to ask you about that. A big difference between the two of us is that I didn't have the internet. Oh, I sound so old now. Like, in college, like, I sort of had it, but, you know, so I didn't grow up online.
Mm-hmm.
And what are you seeing around what's going on online around sex?
So I have a funny story about this, actually, which is sort of a good segue into this whole thing. So last night I was searching for images for my column that's going up today on Playpen Report, because I searched for my own images.
And what's your column on?
Today my one is on the little nasty comments made about sex workers and how they've personally affected me, and about actually ending two experiences that really have hurt me, and that, you know, about one friendship that I don't have anymore because of her, which was amazing. She's very progressive, cool person who I really like. She was like the last person I thought would have a problem with me doing sex work. And we ended up, we're not friends anymore, actually, because of that. So it's a little bit about that.
And this is on playpen.com?
Playpenreport.com.
Playpenreport.com. Yes. Okay.
But I was looking for images, so I was looking through Tumblr, and I was doing this search through Tumblr, and I typed in whore on the search terms. Fascinating thing about Tumblr, half of it was porn that came up under the tag whore. Half of it was porn, with lots of, you know, these hungry whores begging for cock. And it was all very cheery. And then the other half was mostly young women, but some young men too, but mostly young women. And by young, I mean like teenage, you know, like probably, well, I guess not teenage.
I hope
not all
legal,
of them.
But it's hard
saying,
to say.
No, I mean, I'm saying like, well, I mean, like most eight. Of, so, okay, wait. So there was porn and separate from that. There were these young women who were writing, and by young women, I mean, like I said, I mean like from like 13 to 22, writing, and they were writing about people who were trying to steal their boyfriends. Super fascinating. If you search for whore on Tumblr, half of it is porn or really poorly written erotica, which I told you I'd have to send you some of that later because it's amazing. Or young women talking about, quote, that whore is trying to steal my man, and lots of threats to kill the whore. There was like, they would be talking about this, quote, whore who's trying to steal their boyfriend and threatening to kill them or beat them up.
Wow.
Super fascinating.
And it's what I find like really interesting about all of it too is like, what if you didn't know what the word whore was, but you heard it and then you Tumble it or Google it or whatever. And then your perception of anything is defined by what you read online.
Yeah. So I think that's interesting. But otherwise, I mean, I think... I read a lot of dating blogs, and I get really bummed at how sex negative it is. You know,
in what way?
Well, there's a lot of stuff about what women should do. I mean, it's basically a lot of it's regurgitated Cosmo stuff, which is not super great.
Which, and if it works, and I'm always quoted in these magazines, and I thank you for some of those quotes. It's awesome. But if this stuff always worked, they wouldn't keep writing it.
Yeah, well, and also I'm like, they just write the same thing over and over again, and a lot of it boils down to, like, I hate the ones that are like, ask a dude what he thinks. I'm like, why do I give a fuck what a random dude thinks about what I'm doing in my sex life, or how I, you know, manage my pubic hair, or about what my pot belly looks like? Why do I give a fuck what some random dude thinks about any woman? If he doesn't like it, then guess what? He can go date someone who doesn't have it. The beautiful thing about it is that there are a million people, billions of people. There are billions of people in this world, right? Billions. If he doesn't like the fact that I have pubic hair, I am short, and I have a pot
pubic hair?
I do have pubic hair. And have a pot belly, and that my nail polish is occasionally chipped, and I am sorry, I'm not going to wait for him to ask me out on the first date and be nervous and be weird, and I'm not going to hold out for 6 dates to fuck him. If I want to fuck him, I will just fuck him. That is that. And if he has a problem with that, he can go date someone who's not me. Like, that's like, I don't understand the whole, like, philosophy. And this, you see this a lot in, like, online dating and like, sex blogs and, like, talking about, like...
So, in those blogs, or is it a lot of, like... why don't they want me versus like, I'm awesome. Like the way.
Yeah. Well, I think it's usually phrased as not why don't they want me. It's why they don't want you.
Interesting.
Which I think gets, it's preying a little bit on the insecurities that everyone has, which is like, why am I being rejected? Or why am I feeling lonely? Or why am I not being sexually satisfied? And, so it kind of preys on that for page views.
How did you become such a strong woman?
I don't know how to answer that. I don't know. I mean, I come from a weird, the women in my family are very weird. That's a big statement, but they're very, kind of have this weird dichotomous I don't know. It's like almost they all have two personalities. They're very strong women. They're very much like wear the pants in the family, have a lot of, very, you know, all working women, all women who are very creative and very active and very, very opinionated. I mean, like, so opinionated. But at the same time, especially my mom's side of the family, which is really like, it's a matriarchy for sure. My grandmother is the head of it all. And she is just one of the most amazing women. And she's like in her early 80s, and she works out every day.
Oh,
and
that's awesome.
And she's like fabulous. She throws cocktail parties, and like she's the head of the Women's Republican something. She's like totally like active and work still works. I mean, and she's in her 80s, and she's like, and she's gorgeous, and she's just like, just the most amazing person.
You're not like, by the way, related to Liz Taylor at all, right?
No,
because you look just like her. So like,
thank you. I don't think so, but thank you so much.
Oh my God. Well, I mean, not just like her. You look like you, but you do look like her.
Well, thank you. I wish that would be cool, and it would be weird because we have similar names. But yeah, no, but you know, but at the same time, with my mom's side of the family, they also have this really weird, very strange, like kind of 50s ideal of what a woman should be, while also completely defying it. Like, they are not that. But at the same time, there's this idea about like presentation, about dressing a certain way, about being thin. Being thin is like a really big thing in my family.
Mine was too.
So big. Huge, huge thing. A lot of self-hatred. I'm a lot of like, and especially because like also, I mean, I guess I'm a little biased because they're my family, but like, my grandmother looks like a movie star. She's in her 80s and she still looks like a movie star. You know, she's just like one of the most beautiful, like objectively, you know, beautiful, conventionally beautiful women I've ever seen. You know, when she was young, now that she's older, you know, she looks much younger than she is. She looks like 60, in her 60s, and she's in her 80s. But still, you know, she looks like an older woman, but she's still just radiantly beautiful. It's everyone who I show a picture of my grandmother, like I'll show them a picture and they'll be like, "That's your grandmother? She's 80? Oh my God, she's so hot." I'm like, "I know, she's gorgeous."
That means you have good genes.
Oh yeah, but she never smoked or did any. She's not as much trouble as I am, so I think she probably was preserved better. But I hope so. But she's so beautiful, and she's the kind of person who she will talk about how fat she is and how ugly she is and how she's not as beautiful as she used to be, and just really like self-deprecating horrible things. And I'm like, how can you say that about yourself when you are so beautiful? And how can you have lived for 80 years and not get that, like, you are so awesome? No, I mean, no, one, you are conventionally beautiful. So it's amazing that you can't see that, because you totally are conventionally. Like, these things that you're complaining about are not real. But on top of that, aside from being conventionally beautiful still, you also have this amazing, like, you have all these interests, you're a very interesting person, you've lived a really fascinating life, and you've done all these amazing things, and really the thing that you focus on is how ugly you are now that you're old, and how you can't lose weight now that you're older. You know? So, and that's, like, totally a thing in my family, and there's a lot of things in my family about, quote, classiness, which doesn't mean anything, I've learned, like, and about, like I said, about presenting well, about like hosting parties and presenting the perfect face. And like, you know, I've written about this before, about how like with my family, it's like the worst things are, that means that you get up and you put your fucking face on. Like, and I find that conflict within myself where I'm like, yeah, I'm opinionated and I have this very strong thing and I have all that. But then also I have this really strong, like, people pleasing streak within me that falls under that. So it's,
we are so cut from the same cloth there, because people always are like, well, you're just like so confident in this. And I'm like, oh,
yeah,
it's, yes, sure, there's a huge part of me that is, but you know, there's that other part of me that was never good enough. Mm-hmm. And there's this really wonderful book called The Female Brain, which goes into how our brains develop. And what surprised me the most was from 0 to 24 months. Mm-hmm. The amount of estrogen that our women's brains are soaked with is the same amount as when you go through puberty.
Really?
So what happens, okay, like, and even as you're in, mm-hmm, utero, there's a lot going on, and how your mom is at that time really impacts who you are. So those first 24 months, before you can even possibly say anything, you are being completely given the messages that you will live with for the rest of your life and have to deal with, whether or not you're even conscious of them. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it, I think, comes from the subconscious place. Now, this is like, we could talk for hours, which is great. Yay! This is a perfect partnership, by the way. Thanks, Abby.
Yes, thank you, Abby.
I want to talk about one other thing before we say goodbye for today, which is you. So your blog is your Tumblr, and that is
theprimlesslife.tumblr.com.
What does primless mean?
Primless is, so prim is kind of like prim and proper. And primless is to be the opposite of that.
Okay, so it'd be like,
it literally, I think the top of my blog has a definition of prim, and then it says the opposite of that under it.
So like, this would be a bad example. I give really bad examples of things, so I'm not going to give it this time. but you're doing a giveaway on your site, on a sex toy thing.
Yes.
So talk to people about this.
So it's coming up soon. I'm working with a couple of other bloggers to put this contest together, and they're the other judges. Can I give them shout outs? Is that okay?
Yeah, totally.
Okay, so the other bloggers, it's Amanda C. from datingismiserable.com. It's Karen Sin, Mama K, from KarenSin.com. Betty Black, who also writes for the Playpen Report. And Dead Cowgirl from DeadCowgirl.com. She's hilarious. If you haven't read her blog, she's amazing. All of these women are really, really amazing people. We're going to put together a contest, thanks to Babe Land and also to Kim Weisberg, who gave me a bunch of stuff from her bachelorette party that was unopened. We have amazing sex toys. We have a bunch of stuff to give away for a storytelling contest. And basically, it's going to be people are going to submit stories about their first time buying a sex toy, their first time using a sex toy, or their funniest or most unusual experience, noteworthy experience with a sex toy. And they're going to be – the stories are going to be –
What's your story?
Oh, you have to wait because I'm going to post it on the blog.
Because I have a good story, too.
You should submit.
I'll submit. I don't want to win, but I'll submit.
Well, or you could post it. Like, we could post it as part of the promotion.
I mean, I love sex toys, but I definitely feel like I have enough to share.
So, I saw your box. You have so
many.
Oh,
that's one box. I know. I have three or four boxes. Oh, my God. And then we'll have to go in the living room after because those are the ones that I just, except for the Enjoy 11, which I have used. So if you come to my house and you touch it, it's stainless steel, so whatever. But but yeah, then I have the ones just for show.
Nice.
But
awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I think this, it brings, I love the conversation because honestly, I would not have had my first orgasm without a sex toy. And I was many years of sexual activity before I had it, so like almost a decade. So the fact that this helped me, like I will always have a soft spot for sex toys.
Yeah.
So the contest is going to start soon. Just check your, follow you on Twitter, check your, check your page. And again, it's Tizzy Wall, TizzyYWall. I'm sure this is not going to be the last time you're on the Hot Socks podcast, but... please visit, check her out online, follow her, smart, sassy, and going places. That's what you are.
Thank you. Yay.
And I'm really excited to work with you. Yay. I'm Jamie Waxman at JAMYE. It's been a long time since someone told me I don't shut up enough or I interrupt too often. And I'm trying, I'm working on these things in my real life too. I want your feedback and your opinions and what you like and what you'd like to see. So follow me on Twitter at JAMYE or leave a comment on the iTunes page. I'll be back again next week with another Hot Socks podcast. Until then, there's a lot of food for thought. This is a pretty, like, it went to some serious places.
We covered an amazing amount of topics in actually a short period of time for what we did.
Yeah, really.
Thank you so much.
I'll just leave you with three words. Four words, cock and ball torture. I don't know. It's something I think about way too much. I'll be back again next week.
Bye.